content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the June 13th, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, we have Elon Musk. He is driving a very battered Cybertruck. The windshield is smashed. The top is knocked off. It's dented in. Inside the vehicle with him, you see two young children with in car seats. And then the other side of the back seat is a chainsaw. On the dashboard is a bottle of prescription pills, and he's wearing a Doge hat. He's driving out of central Washington, D.C. You can see the Capitol in the background, and there's smoke and rubble. There's a bus with pillars on top of it and a smashed-up car behind him. The headline is Crashing Out. Musk leaves Washington with a bruised reputation and a legacy of destruction. We'll get that in the controversy of the week. Start with the first main story. Courts deal Trump a setback on tariffs. What happened? President Trump doubled down on his tariff agenda this week and hiked import taxes on steel and aluminum from 25% to 50%. After a court found that many of his Liberation Day levies had been imposed illegally. The Court of International Trade, a panel of three federal judges, one a Trump appointee, ruled unanimously last week that the president had exceeded his authority by claiming emergency powers to tax imports from nearly every country. Hours later, a federal judge in a separate case ruled that Trump lacked the power to impose tariffs to reorder the global economy. The trade court decision briefly halted Trump's 30% tariffs on China, 25% tariffs on some goods from Mexico and Canada, and a blanket 10% tariffs on most imports. But an appellate court stayed the ruling pending an appeal. Trump assailed the judges as backroom hustlers and called on the Supreme Court to overrule them. His economic advisor said that even if the justices side with the trade court, Trump had other mechanisms for imposing levies. Rest assured, tariffs are not going away, said Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick. Trump announced his higher tariffs on metals imposed under a different authority and unaffected by the court rulings at a rally at U.S. Steel in Pennsylvania. The measures mean nobody's going to be able to steal your industry, the president told cheering steel workers. Trump later griped it was extremely hard to strike a deal with Chinese President Xi Jinping, and accused his counterpart of violating a trade truce that lowered triple-digit tariffs while the countries work on a long-term deal. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said the talks were a bit stalled. What the editorial said: the trade court's ruling was vital not just for our sputtering economy, but also for the rule of law, said the Wall Street Journal. Trump's use of a 1977 law granting the president emergency powers to deal with any unusual and extraordinary threat was a specious power grab. He cited both the long-running fentanyl crisis and the trade deficit as emergencies, allowing him to seize tariff powers the Constitution grants to Congress. Now the courts have affirmed America doesn't have a king who can rule by decree. It's hard to believe U.S. trade policy could get any more confused and confusing, said Bloomberg, but somehow it has. The paused ruling has only deepened the uncertainty and havoc wrought by Trump's fickle tariff agenda. And trade, as usual, won't resume until the Supreme Court decides whether the White House can declare non-emergencies to be emergencies. As we await that decision, businesses will avoid making major investments, and foreign countries, realizing the justices could suddenly delete Trump's tariffs, will feel little need to strike trade deals. What the columnist said. The steel tariffs may give domestic producers a boost, said Scott Horsley at NPR.org. But for every U.S. steelworker, there are about 80 people working for companies that use steel. Many will be stung by higher prices on imported metals, with ripple effects hitting the auto, mining, and construction sectors. Analysts say the 25% steel tariffs Trump imposed in his first term cost tens of thousands of downstream manufacturing jobs. And consumers will see price hikes on goods ranging from washing machines to a six-pack of beer. Trump's trade war may have hit a constitutional brick wall, said Gary Winslet in the Washington Post, but it isn't over. Trump now has several options. He could ignore the rulings, triggering an immediate constitutional crisis. He could prevail on Congress to grant him sweeping tariff powers, or turn to statutory tools that are more cumbersome than emergency orders, but are quite exploitable. There's another choice. Embrace victimhood and lambast the judges for blocking the greatness he was trying to restore while privately welcoming a rescue from economic chaos. That would be the wise thing to do, said Douglas Schoen and Carly Cooperman in The Hill. Trump's tariffs have inflicted steep damage, whipsawing markets, dimming consumer confidence, and slowing economic growth. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development just downgraded its 2025 U.S. growth forecast to 1.6% from 2.2% it projected in March, citing the impact of tariffs. And polls show Americans don't like the import taxes. 58% say they hurt the economy, and 74% say they boost prices. The president should take this blessing in disguise and shift course. And yet, as happens so often, Trump may prove to be his own worst enemy. And a second shorter main story. Ukraine's shock drone blitz rewrites rules of war. What happened? Ukrainian drones rained down on Russian planes parked at airfields deep inside Russian territory this week, destroying or damaging a third of the country's nuclear-capable bombers in a stunning humiliation for Moscow. In a covert op 18 months into planning, 117 drones in wooden containers were loaded onto commercial trucks and ferried across the border. Once they reached spots within range of five Russian air bases, including one above the Arctic Circle and one far east in Siberia, Ukrainian agents opened the lids of the containers all at once via remote control, allowing the drones to fly out and hit the Russian bombers as they sat parked. Ukraine said 41 planes were hit, causing $7 billion in damage. Video taken by the drones and by gobsmacked Russian bystanders show huge plumes of smoke over Russian bases. As Russia reeled from the attack, Ukrainian forces used explosives planted on the seabed to bomb the Kerch Bridge, which connects Russia with the occupied Crimean Peninsula. The crucial supply artery had to close briefly. President Trump said he held a phone call with Russian President Vladimir Putin, lasting an hour and 15 minutes. President Putin did say, and very strongly, that he will have to respond to the drone attack, Trump said. It was not a conversation that will lead to immediate peace. What the columnist said. Cue the Star Wars theme music, said Mark Toth and Jonathan Sweet in The Hill. Ukraine's epic, unforeseen drone attack shocked Russia and the world and changed the momentum of the three-year war. Some of the 295 strategic bombers it took out were the same type that had launched missiles at Ukrainian cities just days earlier. And Russia doesn't make those anymore. Ukraine showed that its own reach is now just as deep as Putin's ballistic missiles. Operation Spiderweb will be ranked among the great raiding parties of military history, said The Economist. Ukraine managed to get unwitting Russian drivers to transport drones thousands of miles inside Russia and use AI to find their targets. Russians are likening the moment to Pearl Harbor. This reveals a vulnerability in not just Russia's military, but every military, said Max Boot in the Washington Post, one that should give every general in the world sleepless nights. Drones costing $1,200 a pop can apparently be sneaked past militarized borders and used to take out a chunk of multi-billion dollar air force. What would prevent the Chinese from doing the same at U.S. air bases, where our planes are clearly visible on satellite imagery? In fact, Chinese interests have for years been buying large amounts of farmland right next to important U.S. military bases, said Phillips Payson O'Brien in The Atlantic. Those strategic spots could be used as staging grounds for drone swarms that would make the Ukrainian attacks look minuscule. The Pentagon clearly has some rethinking to do. In the meantime, Ukraine has proved that whether the U.S. backs it or not, it still has cards to play. And the controversy of the week. Musk. What did he achieve in Washington? Elon Musk says it was X, A-E-A-X-I-I, his five-year-old son, who gave him the black eye he sported last week during last week's farewell Oval Office meeting with President Trump. But that bruise was an unmistakable metaphor for his tumultuous government service, said Jonathan Allen and Zoe Richards in NBCNews.com. From the start of his 130-day stint as a special government employee, the Department of Government Efficiency boss waged open war on the federal bureaucracy, firing workers by the thousands and gutting entire agencies, most notably USAID, with the stated goal of slashing $2 trillion from the federal budget. Musk never came close. By DOGE's own dubious figures, it saved a mere $175 billion, and Musk's haphazard, inhumane, and counterproductive cuts could end up costing taxpayers $135 billion this year alone, by one analysis. Trump's favorite weird billionaire destroyed his own reputation in the process, said Monica Hess in the Washington Post. Tesla sales are in free fall, and his favorability rating now hovers in the 30s. This isn't just a result of the Nazi salute or the chainsaw or the 14-ish children or allegations denied by Musk that his rampage through Washington was fueled by a cocktail of ketamine, MDMA, Adderall, and psychedelic mushrooms. It was that the planet's richest person, with the freedom to do anything he wanted, chose to bring American governance to its knees. Musk is leaving with understandable bitterness, said Dace Potas in USA Today. He made a genuine effort to cut government waste at great personal cost, only for Republicans to draft a big, beautiful spending bill that will add $3.6 trillion to the deficit over a decade. Musk slammed the bill this week as a disgusting abomination and hinted he might try to unseat Republicans who backed it in the 2026 midterms. DOGE was doomed from the start, said Mark Antonio Wright in National Review. The government's financial crisis stems from decades of overspending on Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare, programs that only Congress can cut, not now terminated funding for transgender puppet shows in Guatemala. With his sky-high promises of balanced budgets, Musk set himself up for failure. The billionaire didn't fail because his ambitions were too grand, said Matt Bai in the Washington Post. He failed because they were so pathetically small. Back in January, even some Trump-hating liberals were quietly hopeful that the mad genius of Silicon Valley might deliver the lean, responsive government of our sci-fi dreams. After all, this is the visionary who revolutionized the electric car industry and slashed the cost of rocket launches with SpaceX. Yet Musk's only big idea for revolutionizing government was to fire as many people as he could, in as humiliating a way as possible. Musk did achieve one of his goals, shredding USAID, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. About 80% of its grants have been terminated, and as a result, starving people in South Sudan are going without food aid, and Kenyan HIV patients without antiretroviral meds. According to a Boston University study, Musk cuts to U.S. aid have already resulted in about 300,000 deaths, most of them children, and that figure will only rise. Maybe Tesla's share price will also rise with Musk back at the helm, and maybe his rockets will one day carry humanity to Mars. But Musk's legacy in Washington is one of disease, starvation, and death, and it should shape how he's seen for the rest of his public life. It's a good week, bad week. It's a good week for visual learners. After reports that Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, is considering reformatting the president's daily intelligence briefing to make him pay attention, potentially as a Fox News-style broadcast delivered by professional news anchors. The problem with Trump is that he doesn't read, an insider explained to NBC. It was a good week for fatalism. After a constituent warned Iowa Senator Joni Ernst at a town hall that people are going to die as a result of the Medicaid cuts in President Trump's big, beautiful bill, leading the Republican to reply, "Well, we're all going to die." Ernst later noted that eternal and everlasting life does await those who embrace my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. It's a good week for parenting after ultra runner Stephanie Case won a 100-kilometer race over mountains in Wales, despite stopping three times to breastfeed her six-month-old daughter. "Well, that was a surprise," Case said of her win. But it was a bad week for eager beavers after Turkish authorities announced new fines for air passengers who leave their seats before the plane has stopped taxiing, or who crowd the aisles waiting to deplane with no thought for the disembarkation priority of the passengers in front of or around you. It was a bad week for deep research after Harvard University stripped tenure from behavioral scientist Francesca Gino, who was found to have falsified data in a number of her studies, including three on human dishonesty. The now former Professor Gino denies the allegations. Finally, it was a bad week for renewables after Dutch meteorologist Remco Verschelberg, in an interview with Belgian television, accused Belgium of stealing some of our wind. Verschelberg says new Belgian wind farms in the North Sea are consuming up to 3% of the wind that would otherwise reach Dutch turbines. Briefing this week is titled Trump's Extremist Brain. Stephen Miller has emerged as an unrivaled power within the White House. What does he want? What is Miller's role? The 39-year-old has two titles: Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy and Homeland Security Advisor. But they don't convey the power Miller wields or the extent to which he's said to be shaping Trump's second-term agenda. Long known for his combative style, frenzied work ethic, and fevered devotion to Trump, the anti-immigration crusader is now also seen as a shrewd operator with a talent for pulling the levers of government. Insiders say Miller has built a strong relationship with his often fickle boss because of his ability to channel Trump's impulses, to articulate them in speeches, and translate them into policy. I call Stephen Trump's brain, said former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, citing Trump's complete trust in Miller. Senator Ben Ray Lujan, Democrat from New Mexico, has a blunter take. As the architect of Trump's ugliest policies, he said, Miller is responsible for all the bad things happening in the United States. Which policies bear his stamp? Miller helped prepare the dozens of executive orders that Trump signed on returning to the Oval Office in January. They included orders to revoke birthright citizenship for the children of undocumented immigrants and of many visa holders. That order was quickly blocked by the courts, and the declaration of a national emergency at the southern border. Miller reportedly pushed Trump to impose tariffs on Mexico and Canada, and having developed a distrust of federal workers, who he believes stymied Trump's first-term agenda, worked closely with the Department of Government efficiency leader Elon Musk to slash government agencies. Miller's wife, Katie Miller, was a DOGE advisor until last week. A zealous opponent of what he calls anti-white bigotry and cancerous communist woke culture, he has driven efforts to eradicate diversity, equity, and inclusion programs and to roll back transgender rights. His obsession, though, is immigration. He has masterminded Trump's efforts to effect mass deportations of undocumented migrants, close legal pathways to citizenship, and used the 1798 Alien Enemies Act to deport alleged gang members. Miller, who vowed Trump's second term would deliver pure bliss for immigration foes, has been preoccupied with the issue since his youth. What sparked that obsession? He grew up in a well-off, Democratic-supporting Jewish family in liberal Santa Monica, California, but said he swung to the right as a teenager after reading Guns, Crime, and Freedom, a 1994 book by Wayne LaPierre, then the CEO of the National Rifle Association. At his public high school, Miller became notorious as a conservative firebrand who relished confrontation. A friend from middle school, Jason Islas, said Miller told him at the start of ninth grade that the pair could no longer associate in part because of Islas' Latino heritage. In the high school paper, Miller complained that Latino students lacked basic English skills, noted the dearth of Latinos in his honors classes, and blasted the school's policy of making bilingual announcements. He became a regular guest on a local conservative talk radio show, appearing dozens of times. Miller kept up the fight at Duke University, where he wrote a biweekly column for the college paper in which he blamed the 9/11 attacks on politically correct domestic security, accused black students of suffering racial paranoia, and attacked professors for being registered Democrats. His writings attracted national attention, and after graduation, Miller headed to Washington, D.C. What did he do there? Miller went to work for former Representative Michelle Bachmann, Republican from Minnesota, an arch conservative whose many controversies included blaming immigrants for bringing in diseases and violence. Then in 2009, he became a staffer for hard right Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions and became known for bombarding fellow GOP aides with mass emails on immigration, sharing links from what one called fringe websites. In 2014, Miller was credited with helping Sessions kill a bipartisan effort at immigration reform. The next year, when Trump announced his candidacy, Miller was riveted by the outsider and his anti-immigrant rhetoric. "It expressed everything I felt at the deepest level of my heart," he said. He joined the Trump campaign, and after Trump's November 2016 victory, helped write the president's blood and soil inauguration speech, which vowed to end American carnage and put America first. Did he play a major role in the administration? Many of Trump's most controversial first-term policies were co-authored by Miller. They included the short-lived ban on travelers from several Muslim-majority nations, the Remain in Mexico policy that prohibited migrants seeking asylum from entering the U.S., and the use of the public health law, Title 42, to suspend U.S. entry during the COVID pandemic. Most notoriously, he promoted the family separation policy that took more than 3,000 migrant children from their parents. When images of anguished families appeared on news networks, sparking a public backlash, a White House advisor told Vanity Fair that Miller actually enjoys seeing those pictures, adding, "He's Waffen SS." Having spent years laying the groundwork for a second Trump term, he is now determined to make an even more transformative impact. What are his plans? His broad goals for the next 4 years are to deport all 14 million undocumented migrants in the U.S., turbocharge efforts to strip naturalized Americans of their citizenship, and expand Trump's executive powers. Miller believes he is saving the U.S. from an apocalypse, said Gene Guerrero, who wrote a 2020 Miller biography, Hate Monger. Trump is likely to keep Miller close despite the controversy he generates. The president said last month that he had considered making Miller his national security advisor, a high-profile West Wing role, but that job would be a downgrade from his current position overseeing a swath of policy areas, said Trump. Stephen is much higher on the totem pole than that. Time for a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. RFK Jr.'s surrender to bird flu. RFK Jr. may have just ruined our best weapon against bird flu, said Jonathan Cohn. The kooky health secretary last week canceled a $766 million contract to develop a human vaccine against the virus that's currently ravaging poultry farms, and could potentially mutate so that it can easily pass among people. With human mortality rates as high as 50% in previous isolated outbreaks, a bird flu pandemic could dwarf the impact of the COVID pandemic, which killed more than 7 million people. That's why the Biden administration awarded a contract to develop a bird flu vaccine to Moderna, the biotech company that created one of the original COVID vaccines. Moderna's secret sauce is mRNA technology, which allows for much quicker vaccine production than traditional methods. But now Kennedy, who has spread egregious lies about the supposed dangers of mRNA vaccines, has killed the effort to develop a bird flu vaccine. A spokesperson called mRNA technology under-tested. That's absurd. The COVID vaccine has been administered to more than 1 billion people and has shown an excellent safety record. Kennedy is imposing his irrational bias against mRNA shots on the public, and it may one day have terrible consequences. Extremism has gone mainstream. What happens when extremism becomes the mainstream? Asked David Korn. That's exactly what's transpiring in MAGA world, where white supremacists and neo-Nazis are now treated as normies. Just look at some of Trump administration's latest hires. The Pentagon's new press secretary, 26-year-old Kingsley Wilson, is a far-right troll who has cheered on the great replacement theory that non-whites are being imported to replace whites, and has claimed Black Lives Matter has an affinity for race-based violence. She's dredged up disproven lies about Leo Frank, a Jewish man lynched by a mob in Georgia in 1915. To lead the special counsel's office, President Trump nominated 30-year-old Paul Ingrassia, who called for Trump to impose martial law after the 2020 election and praised the January 6 rioters. Ingrassia has stated that exceptional white men built this country and are the ones most capable of appreciating the fruits of our heritage. Laura Loomer, a far-right provocateur and anti-Islam bigot, used her influence with Trump to engineer the firings of 6 National Security Council officials she deemed insufficiently loyal to the dear leader. In this administration, extremism in the service of Trump is no vice, and it's not even extremism. This column comes from China. America's loss will be our gain. Donald Trump's attack on universities is a spectacular act of self-sabotage, said Zhang Ji, one that threatens to unravel decades of academic dominance by the U.S. while achieving little beyond petty ideological victories. Trump wants to keep out foreign students, barring them first from Harvard and then from all U.S. universities. And his State Department says it will aggressively revoke visas for Chinese students. The courts are trying to block the moves, but even if they ultimately succeed, the damage has already been done. Trump has shown the world that the U.S. is a country where education is hostage to political whims, where visas can be revoked over a tweet, where academic freedom lasts only until a president takes offense. Already, the best and brightest students in the world have begun choosing institutions in Australia, Europe, and Asia, where the governments welcome them. This exodus of talent will hamper the U.S. for decades to come. The cleverest students in the world used to study at Harvard, MIT, Stanford, and the like, and many of them became Nobel laureates or founded successful companies. No longer. A government that claims to put America first is driving away the very minds that sustain its edge and innovation. U.S. universities will still be prestigious, of course, but without a diverse international cohort, their vitality will fade. The last word, our in-depth article, how melatonin took over kids' bedtime. Parents hail the hormone served up in gummies and bright packages as a sleep saver, said Michael Schulson in Undark. Yet its risks and long-term effects remain largely unknown. 2 years ago at a Stop and Shop in Rhode Island, the Danish neuroscientist and physician Henriette Edemann-Kellesen visited an aisle stocked with sleep aids containing melatonin. She looked around in amazement. Then she took out her phone and snapped a photo to send to colleagues back home. It was really pretty astonishing, she recalled recently. In Denmark, as in many countries, the hormone melatonin is a prescription drug for treating sleep problems, mostly in adults. Doctors are supposed to prescribe it to children only if they have certain developmental disorders that make it difficult to sleep, and only after the family has tried other methods to address the problem. But at the Rhode Island Stop and Shop, melatonin was available over the counter as a dietary supplement, meaning it receives slightly less regulatory scrutiny, in some respects, than a package of Skittles. Many of the products were marketed for children, in colorful bottles filled with liquid drops, and chewable tablets and bright gummies that look and taste like candy. A quiet but profound shift is underway in American parenting, and more caregivers turn to pharmacological solutions to help children sleep. What makes that shift unusual is that it's largely taking place outside the traditional boundaries of healthcare. Instead, it's driven by the country's sprawling dietary supplements industry, which critics have long said has little regulatory oversight, and which may get a boost from Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is widely seen as an ally to supplement makers. 30 years ago, few people were giving melatonin to children outside of a handful of controlled experiments. Even as melatonin supplements grew in popularity among adults in the late 1990s in the United States and Canada, some of those products carried strict warnings not to give them to younger people. But with time, the age floor dropped, and in the mid-2000s, news reports and academic surveys suggest some early adopters were doing just that. Try it for ages 11 and up only, one CNN report warned at the time. By 2013, according to a Wall Street Journal article, a handful of companies were marketing melatonin products specifically for kids. And today, it's almost like a vitamin now, said Judith Owens, a pediatric sleep specialist at Harvard Medical School. Usage is growing, including among children who are barely out of diapers. Academic surveys suggest that as many as 1 in 5 preteens in the U.S. now take melatonin at least occasionally, and that some younger children consume it multiple times per week. The trend has unsettled many childhood sleep researchers. It is a hormone that you are giving to young children, and there's just very little research on the long-term effects of this, said Lauren Hartstein, a childhood sleep researcher at the University of Arizona. In a 2021 journal article, David Kinaway, a professor of physiology at the University of Adelaide in Australia, noted that melatonin can bind to receptors in the pancreas, the heart, fat tissues, and reproductive organs. Kinaway once held a patent on a veterinary drug that uses melatonin to boost the fertility of ewes. Distributing the hormone over the counter to American children, he has argued, is akin to a vast, uncontrolled medical experiment. The urge, the desperate, frantic, all-consuming urge to get a child to fall asleep, is familiar to many parents. So is the impulse to satisfy that urge through drugs. In the early 20th century, parents sometimes administered an opiate called laudanum to help young children sleep, even though it could be fatal. Decades later, when over-the-counter antihistamines like Benadryl became popular, some parents began using them off-label as a sleep aid. The body secretes melatonin from a pea-sized gland nestled in the brain, typically starting in the early evening. Levels peak after midnight and drop off a few hours before sunrise. When a child takes a 1 milligram dose of melatonin, the hormone quickly enters their bloodstream, signaling the brain that it's time for sleep. Melatonin reaches levels in the blood that can be more than 10 times higher than natural peak concentrations. It's hard to know for sure who first decided to market melatonin specifically to children, but a key player seems to be Zach Zarbach, a Utah pediatrician and father of 4 boys who in 2008 began selling a drug-free honey-based cough syrup. In 2011, his company, Zarbee's, introduced a version of its children's cough remedy that contained melatonin. Soon after, Zarbee's launched a line of melatonin supplements tailored to children. In a 2014 press release, Zarbach, who did not respond to an interview request, stresses that a child shouldn't need to take something to fall asleep every night. But melatonin, he said, could act like a reset button for your bedtime routine when things got out of whack. Is melatonin a harmless natural supplement or a sleep drug? The culture at times seems unsure. It's easy to find parents fretting in online forums about whether the gummies are safe. Daycare workers have undergone criminal prosecution after providing melatonin to their charges without parental consent. In their marketing, meanwhile, supplement companies consistently describe their melatonin products as drug-free, non-habit-forming, and safe. In one promotional video for Zarbee's, Zarbach, wearing sky blue scrubs, tells parents that in recent short and long-term studies, melatonin has been shown to be safe and effective for children. Echoing language used across the industry, Zarbee's melatonin gummies are marketed today as safe and drug-free. Such claims raise hackles among sleep scientists. "That kind of advertising is unconscionable," wrote Kenaway in an email. "Melatonin ingested, whether in a gummy or a tablet, is being administered as a drug," he wrote. Among other things, Kenaway worries that long-term melatonin use could have unintended effects, including on the developing reproductive system. Last year, the Council for Responsible Nutrition, a leading supplement industry group, published voluntary guidelines for its members. Among them, put products in child deterrent packaging, tell people to consult a pediatrician before using melatonin, and warn caregivers that melatonin is for occasional and/or intermittent use only. Plenty of manufacturers aren't part of CRN, and it's not hard to find suppliers that aren't in compliance with those recommendations. And whether parents follow the recommendations is something else entirely. User reviews and academic surveys indicate that some parents are dosing regularly for months or years on end, and the products themselves seemed packaged for long-term use. For example, the company Mary Ruth's sells bottles of children's melatonin gummies labeled 2-month supply. Natrol, a popular brand that warns caregivers that the product is for occasional short-term use only, sells bottles containing 140 doses. Meanwhile, as melatonin sales climb, a growing body of evidence points to cases of misuse. One issue, children seem to be sometimes finding and swallowing gummies and other melatonin products. Calls to poison control centers for pediatric melatonin ingestion increased 530% between 2012 and 2021, according to one analysis published by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In such cases, mostly, nothing happened. Among small children, the large majority of the incidents were resolved without the child experiencing symptoms at all. When symptoms do appear, they tend to be mild. Drowsiness, for example, or gastrointestinal upset. Achieving a lethal dose of melatonin appears to be virtually impossible, said Laura LeBay, a forensic toxicologist at NMS Labs, which provides toxicology testing services. Still, some experts have expressed concern that melatonin misuse might, in rare cases, contribute to more serious outcomes. In 2015, Sandra Bishop Freeman, now the chief toxicologist at the North Carolina office of the chief medical examiner, was called to review a tragic case. A 3-month-old girl had died in her crib. More than 20 bottles of melatonin were found in the home, and an investigation showed that the girl and her twin sister had been given 5-milligram doses of melatonin multiple times per day to help them sleep. The infant's blood levels of melatonin were orders of magnitude above the natural range. Oftentimes, when I explore topics, it's because we find things that were previously unknown or confusing to us, Bishop Freeman told UNDART. She wasn't sure if melatonin had contributed to the infant's death, but as she read more about the hormone, she felt concerns, especially when her office received several more cases involving elevated levels of melatonin. It was hard to just tell the pathologist, no worries, everyone thinks it's safe, so you're fine, she said. In 2022, Bishop Freeman and colleagues published a paper detailing 7 cases of undetermined pediatric deaths where blood work revealed elevated levels of melatonin. We don't want to overstate these findings, she said. The causes of deaths are unknown, and the presence of melatonin may just be a coincidence. But her team can't rule out the hormone as a possible contributor, she said, and investigators should be alert to elevated melatonin levels, which may sometimes be overlooked. LeBay said she found those concerns plausible. But, she added, I think I'm still waiting for the paper that says this was a pure melatonin death and there was no other contributing cause to that death. Steve Mister, the president and CEO of the Council for Responsible Nutrition, said the supplement industry has taken steps to ensure that melatonin is used responsibly, including the guidelines his organization issued last year. He pushed back against suggestions that the supplement industry was not a responsible steward of melatonin, or that it was unwise for the hormone to be sold as an over-the-counter supplement. Look at the safety and look at the number of doses that are sold in this country every year, and how few adverse events there are, and how little evidence that there is a concern, Mister said. Other countries, he added, may choose to limit melatonin to prescription use only. They like the way their system is set up. That doesn't mean that it's right for the U.S. For parents whose children struggle to fall asleep, the cost of an interminable bedtime can feel high. Exhausted children, burned out parents, and family conflict that stretches into the night. In online videos and forums, parents disclose insecurity. We are now at the stage in parenthood where we drug our kids, one mother says in a TikTok. And gratitude, it saved our sanity, writes a parent on Reddit. Caregivers talk about their children getting better rest, but it can seem as if the supplement is as much for the parent's mental health as it is for the children's restful sleep. In conversations, physicians and psychologists who devote their careers to children's sleep stress the importance of a good night's rest. But some worry melatonin is often used as a shortcut and suggest there are more effective paths to improve sleep that families could take, especially if they had better support. Candace Alfano, a professor of psychology at the University of Houston, runs a center devoted to studying childhood sleep and anxiety. In 2020 and 2021, she and her team conducted a survey of sleep health among children in foster care who struggle with insomnia at far higher rates than the general population. Pharmacological treatments, they found, were widespread. More than 1 in 10 foster parents reported receiving a prescription medicine to help the children sleep, and close to half were using melatonin at least occasionally and often regularly to help the children sleep. Alfano's team has recently developed a sleep treatment for foster families that, she said, may offer an alternative intervention to drugs and supplements. The initial findings from a small pilot suggest it's effective. The appeal of melatonin, though, remains, both for caregivers and for the pediatricians who advise them, Alfano says. It's seemingly a quick and easy suggestion. You know, here's something you could go get over the counter. You don't even need a prescription from me. But the goal, she said, is something else. To teach these children how to sleep, rather than just get them to sleep. This was adapted from an article first published in UNDARK. That's UNDARK. Here's one of the health and science shorts for you. Can we refreeze the Arctic? Arctic sea ice has been retreating by more than 12% each decade. That loss fuels climate change because white ice reflects the sun's heat back out to space while dark water absorbs it. And it also creates its own feedback loop, with warming water melting ever more ice to the point where the North Pole ice cap is expected to disappear entirely in the summer by 2040. The British research company Real Ice has hatched an ambitious plan to reverse the trend by thickening the winter ice so that it lasts longer into the summer months. It could do so, the company says, by drilling holes into the ice and pumping in water, which quickly freezes. As it congeals, the water acts almost like lava, Real Ice co-founder Sean Sherwin tells Scientific American. The ice formation starts almost instantly. His team thinks it could refreeze up to 1 million square kilometers of ice, enough to cover Texas and New Mexico, if they can build 500,000 underwater drilling robots. It's a tall order, and it would be a kind of geoengineering never before attempted. But we've got to do something, Sherwin says. And flipping over to the talking points page, we'll read Democrats solving the man problem. Democrats have revealed a central prong of their strategy to connect with men, said Nia Malika Henderson in Bloomberg, and the operative word is cringe. To discover a message that will help win back the young male voters who have fled the party in droves, Democrats are spending $20 million on an initiative codenamed SAM, which stands for Speaking with American Men, a strategic plan. It will study male-dominated online communities and, says the prospectus, the syntax, language, and content that gains their attention and virality in these spaces. Great. To relate to disaffected males who see Democrats as elite, risk-averse technocrats, the party's plan is to have a high-paid consultant study them as if they're an alien species. I could break it down for free, said Ricky Schlott in the New York Post. It's all the man bashing. Democrats are hemorrhaging young men because they push a progressive ideology that maligns everything from workouts to red meat as right-wing and trashes masculinity as intrinsically toxic. Sam has been ridiculed across the board, including by left-wing podcasters, said Aswin Susbenang and Andrew Perez and Rolling Stone. But the consultants behind it are trying to engage with real problems. They include the financial worries faced by young men who are being outpaced by women in the workplace, and the fact that many view Democrats as weak and want leadership that signals strength in an unstable world, something they believe Trump provides. Democrats' man problem is overblown, said Michael A. Cohen in MSNBC.com. Yes, there was an 11-point male voter shift to Republicans from 2020 to 2024, but polling across the past four elections shows male support dropped sharply when Democrats ran a woman and rebounded when the party nominated a man. Reaching young men is a worthy goal, said David French in the New York Times, but too many are getting this backward. What resonates with them is not a political message, but a personal one. At a time when young men are struggling, right-wing influencers approach them from a perceived place of love and affection. It's a profound shift from the message of the cultural left, that the future is female and masculine traits such as stoicism and competitiveness are harmful. To hear that they're valued and loved, our sons should not have to turn to books or podcasts or social media. It's up to us, parents, teachers, pastors, to fill the void in young men's hearts and offer a vision of masculine virtue that embraces compassion instead of MAGA's vicious aggression. And some of the short notes. The first report from the presidential Make America Healthy Again Commission, touted by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as being based on gold standard science, cites numerous studies that do not exist and misrepresents the findings of many real studies. Such errors are characteristic of the use of generative artificial intelligence. Companies are pulling back on support for this month's Pride celebrations, citing a rise in anti-LGBTQ sentiment, pressures from the Trump administration, and tighter budgets amid economic uncertainty. The nonprofit that runs New York City Pride said a quarter of its sponsors, including MasterCard, Nissan, and Garnier, have canceled or lowered their funding, resulting in a $750,000 shortfall. Global average temperatures are expected to warm 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels in 2 years, according to new data from the World Meteorological Association. 7 years ago, a UN climate panel predicted it would take until 2040 for Earth to reach that critical threshold, beyond which the impacts of climate change are expected to accelerate. On the poll watch, 21% of Israeli adults think Israel and Palestine state can peacefully coexist, down from 35% in 2023 and from 50% in 2013. 33% believe Israel should govern Gaza after the war, while 16% say the people of Gaza should decide who governs. And we'll finish today's show with a quote from Bill Gates, quoted an American lawyer. He says, "We always overestimate the change that will occur in the next 2 years and underestimate the change that will occur in the next 10. And with that, we have run out of time for today's show. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.